This is the Reds Hot Stove Room.
The Reds are on the radio.
The Reds Hot Stove League is brought to you by the Holy Grail Banks Tavern and Grill, Beacon Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, JTM Food Group, MSA Architects, Thompson McConnell Cadillac, and by Document Destruction. The Reds Hot Stove League is also brought to you by...
And this one belongs to the Reds!
CBTS, a Cincinnati Bell Company, technology solutions for business. Your tri-state Chevy dealers. Check out Chevy's award-winning lineup only at your tri-state Chevy dealers. The Healthcare Management Group, greater care for greater Cincinnati. And by Woody Sander Ford, I-75 at Mitchell Avenue, right in the middle of everywhere. Now, the Reds Hot Stove League on News Radio 700 WLW, the home of the Reds.
And good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Reds Hot Stove League. We are live from the Holy Grail Banks. We're presented by Budweiser. I'm Jim Day. My pleasure to be here tonight. Got a good crowd on hand here at the Holy Grail Banks. We thank you for all being here tonight. And we want to talk about this guy sitting to my left, because on September 16th, 1988, with the Los Angeles Dodgers in town, 27 men came to the plate, and 27 men were retired. A perfect game and forevermore. He is Mr. Perfect, Tom Browning. How we doing?
Doing good. Doing good. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Is there any time that you're not introduced as Mr. Perfect?
Not in my house.
Publicly, though.
No. It's a moniker that... One, it's hard to live up to, but one, I just kind of accept it, and I don't take too much credence in it.
Wow.
Hour and 52 minutes of my life, I was perfect, and that's it.
Think about that. An hour and 52 minutes.
Yeah.
With the length of game. That's one of the things I want to ask you about here coming up in a bit, but you've been making a lot of appearances for the club. Every time I look up, I'm seeing you on the road for the Hall of Fame, or you're in some town doing this or doing that. Do you enjoy it?
I do. I love being involved. I just stepped away from the coaching part and got involved with the marketing and the Hall of Fame and Reds Community Fund, and they've kept me busy. They've gotten a lot of things for me to do, and I really enjoyed this summer going to the community or the retirement villages. You know, I go to about five or six of them, and, a lot of them were 75, 76 Reds fans and also 90s fans, so it was nice to be able to relate to them. But, they kept me busy. They're continuing to keep me busy. They gave me the greatest gig in the world, which is that Sunday brunch with Browning at the stadium.
Yeah. So. that was a good gig.
Yeah.
Brunch with Browning. I got to tell you, did you ever think that you would have a business card that would say marketing on it?
No. Well, like I said, I Joe Nuxall and I ran around together a lot during my playing days. And, I did a lot of stuff with him. And he kind of really showed me the ropes as far as how to get out in the public and get amongst the fans. And, so I just wanted to be able to carry on the tradition. But I enjoy doing it. I miss coaching. I love coaching. It's good to see some of the kids that I've coached that are starting to make their way to the big leagues. But, like I said, I thank the Reds for keeping me involved, and I'm more than happy to do whatever I need to do on their behalf.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to pick your brain about, because you said you've put the coaching, at least from now, behind you. But you were involved with a lot of these players that fans are getting to know right now on the minor league level. In fact, I remember a few years back, I asked you, all right, give me a couple pitchers to keep an eye on. One guy you said was Tyler Mallett.
Yeah.
And it comes to fruition that, wow, what a pitcher. What did you like about him?
He just never looked rattled out there. He looked like when he took the mound, he had a purpose. He attacked hitters. Consistently. He didn't mind pitching inside, but he just was able to go out there and gobble up innings for me. He could get, if he wasn't so restricted on his pitch count, because we had to back him off in August, and I told all of my starters that was going to happen because I expected them all to be frontline guys. So, but he would get you to the sixth and seventh inning consistently, and most of the time he had a chance to win the ball game or we were winning. So, that's the thing I looked at, the guys that you could rely on to go out there and get you six and seven innings consistently and take care of that bullpen.
When you look at the number of pitchers that are going to be vying for spots in the Reds rotation or in the bullpen, A lot of these guys you know, the Sal Romanos, Robert Stevensons, Cody Reed, Amir Garrett, Finnegan, Michael Lorenzen, Rookie Davis. It's a tremendous group of arms, and you're only hoping that two or three guys step up, correct?
Yeah, that's all we need. And, you know, I think, and I saw Mac Jenkins during the during Reds Fest, and that's the thing I said. He said, you know, the cool thing about all these young pitchers now is they got a year under their belt.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe some of them, I think we saw Sal Romano turn the corner a little bit at the end. I think Robert kind of figured it out a little bit. So these guys, through time out there with their feet to the fire, figured out how to get people out. You know, they didn't all figure it out, and some of them had to go to AAA, and some of them made it back, and some didn't. But we got a good core of pitchers. We got a lot of good arms. It's just a matter of getting them to be consistent and be able to do what is expected out of a starting pitcher.
Take us back to when you were a young pitcher, and you were just on the cusp of getting big league time, and when you first started becoming a major league pitcher, what are the things that you try to coach to make that step, and what are some things that you saw that maybe some of these guys are lacking that they need to develop this year?
Well, I went to Instructional League in 82. My first year I get drafted, and they taught me the screwball, and they, you know, and back then Instructional League, and I know we've kind of got back to it, was kind of an invitation thing. If you had a good enough year and you were a prospect, then they brought you in, and back then it was Tampa, but they took you to Instructional League to kind of get a leg up on the guys not there. You know, going into spring training, you had a little bit more of an advantage. But I got to my first big league camp in 1984, first day of live BP, and I had no idea. In my first big league camp, I was scared to death. But I go to big league camp, and I'm walking out for live BP, and Dave Parker comes up, and thank God he put his arm around me and said, listen, kid, this is as much for us as it is for you. Don't be trying to get us out. You just to work on throwing strikes and lengthening your arm out and give us something to hit. And I did. I did that my whole career. But the first three pitches I threw that day, he hit home runs. And the third one, he stepped out and he said, hey, did that hit my Porsche? So the next one No, I don't know, because the next one I threw under his chin. But And he just kind of
threw the
back.
Cobra. You threw one under the chin.
Yeah, well, he told me what to do, and I said, man, you didn't tell me you're going to brag about it. So, but I just learned that you had to. My identity was I was a fastball changeup guy. I worked both sides of the plate, and I worked up and down as well. You know, but I had a plan of attack. When a hitter stepped in the box, I had a plan of attack to go after this hitter, and I would say 80 to 90% of the time, it was the same way I approached every hitter the same. There were certain guys you learned you got to pitch them differently. But for the most part, you know, if I made quality pitches and they knew it, if the guy was looking first ball, fastball, I was a first ball, fastball guy. If I put him in a good spot, I probably got him out. I didn't try to strike guys out. I just tried to stay away from the fat part of the bat. But I wanted him to put the ball in play because I was able to go deeper in the game because of the pitch efficiency. So.
One thing that you used to do is work quickly.
Yeah.
And I even had a conversation with Barry Larkin recently. It was a public conversation, in fact, right before Reds Fest. And he said he loved to be on the field when you were pitching because he feels like the defense is better when the pitcher works quickly. Many guys have said that. Talked to Zach Cozart 1,000 times in the years past about that. Why do some pitchers not get that?
Well, I don't think they have a plan of attack. And I say that, you know, like I said, when a hitter stepped in the box, I knew what my third pitch was before I threw my first, because that third pitch was going to be my out pitch. And hopefully it was up and in because I got ahead low and away with strike one and strike two. Now, that didn't always work out that way, but that was my plan of attack. I don't think these guys have routines or have a plan of attack, I think, because of the generation they're in now, excuse me, that the college coaches call all the pitches. You know, they're never allowed to shake off and never allowed to do anything. But when they get to pro ball, they kind of have to figure all that out on their own now. And then they're not sure how to do it. So I think they just throw whatever the catcher puts down with no thought of why he put that pitch down, that he wanted a fastball up and in or whatever he wanted. I think sometimes they don't think about a pitch sequence to hitters. I think they just throw whatever the catcher puts down, and hopefully they throw a strike. If not, then hopefully the next one, that kind of thing. Whereas, you know, I just knew my third pitch was going to be up and in, whether I had 0-2, 1-2, 2-0, That was my third pitch because it's a hard pitch to lay off for a right-handed power hitter, and if I got it in there far enough, I got a quick fly ball. But to me, I just don't think that they've never been allowed to throw the ball over the plate and see what happens without any repercussions. You know, that's where I like live BP. I've always loved live BP for the hitters, and the pitchers could get stretched out, and they could throw a ball down the middle, and the guy's going to hit a ground ball to shortstop. You know, it doesn't happen all the time. I wouldn't suggest throwing down the middle, but don't be afraid to make mistakes over the plate. You might get an out out of it. So,
interesting stuff, as always, for Mr. Perfect Tom Brown. We've got a live mic, got a good crowd here at the Holy Grail Banks, and we are going to take your questions. Anyone that has a question, come up front here. Anything you have ever wanted to ask Mr. Perfect Tom Brown, or actually the live mic is over here. Dave Yiddy Armbruster over here is the man. We're also taking your calls at 513-749-7000, 749-7000. And coming up, I want to get the story of the perfect game ball and what happened to it.
Okay.
Will you tell that story?
Sure.
That's coming up. Stay with us. Much more to come. You're listening to the Reds Hot Stove League live from the Holy Grail Banks, presented by Budweiser. You're listening to the Reds Hot Stove League live from the Holy Grail Banks, presented by Budweiser. We are so happy to have Mr. Perfect, Reds Hall of Famer Tom Browning in the house tonight, and I am merely Jim Day. The Reds Holiday Gift Pack is on sale right now, starting at only $40. The gift pack includes four ticket credits, good towards any combination of games next season. Plus, you get a new limited edition luxury throw blanket featuring the Great American Ballpark skyline. You can purchase your Reds Holiday Gift Pack today at Reds Kiosk, at the kiosk located in the Kenwood Town Center, or at reds.com/holiday. Some restrictions apply, and we hope you're having a happy holiday season. Happy Hanukkah to those Reds fans out there of the Jewish faith. And we've got Christmas around the corner. What's Christmas like in the Browning household nowadays? A lot of kids, I would imagine.
Yeah, lots of wrappers, lots of crap. Yeah, stuff everywhere.
That's beautiful. We were talking before the break, and I want to get this story in. We've got Steve from Dayton coming up on the phone and the live mic if anyone wants to step up here, but when I first heard of the story of what happened to the baseball from the perfect game that you once had on a mantle, right?
Correct.
And can you tell us what happened to the baseball from there?
Yeah. It sat there for, oh, my goodness, what, 88? So it probably sat there for 3 or 4 years. And it was the only thing on the mantle. And my kids, my boys always knew that if the ball had writing on it, they weren't allowed to play with it. Okay, we had a signature on it, whatever,
right.
Leave it alone. Well, this one didn't have anything on it. It sat there, like I said, for 3 or 4 years. And I remember one day coming home, and it was gone. And I said, Tanner, I said, you guys know what happened to that ball? It was up there. He goes, yeah, Kyle and I were out back playing with it. And he said, Kyle hit it in the woods. I said, well, did you go get it? And he goes, nah, it was in the woods. Why? I said, well, because it was the last out of my perfect game. He goes, oh, sorry.
So this house was in northern Kentucky, right? I remember the house being up on a hill, and there's
no,
a big
this is
ravine.
My first house.
Oh,
this is
your first house? Okay.
On Hurstbourne, yeah.
So somewhere around there, there's a baseball.
It's nesting.
And if not, someone found it in the woods and has no idea it is a historical baseball.
Nah, they didn't find it in them woods, no. Nah, that's but I after the game was over, though, the kids that worked the ground or the umpire's room said, hey, we got some used balls. Would you like some game used balls? And I said, yeah. And I said, there was one in particular that I wanted. I don't know what inning it was, but Mickey Hatcher, the first baseman, mm-hmm. came up to the plate with a black bat and that silver anniversary writing on the Louisville Slugger. And I jammed him so bad that when I got the ball back, it had Louisville Slugger in reverse on the ball in silver.
Really?
And I was so proud of that I threw it into Pete Rose to show him how bad I jammed him. So after the game was over, and I said, yeah, I want 6 or 7. I said, but there's one in particular, because I already had the last out in my glove. I said, there's one in particular that I wanted, and they brought that back, and I gave that one to my dad. So I know that one's still around. So,
wow. You had, obviously, some teammates that are folklore here in Reds country. A member of the 1990 World Series champion team. Who are some of your favorite guys that you play with? If someone, I know it's a tough question, because you play with a lot of guys, but who were the guys that were your favorite teammates? Give us maybe three.
Oh, gosh, I liked them all. Buddy Bell was probably my the coolest guy, the most professional guy. I'm not going to count the Big Red Machine guys, you know, Pete and Tony and Griff right. and Davey. I mean, they were awesome. It was a pleasure being around them. But, I mean, as far as Ronnie Oster, Buddy Bell, you know, Barry and I, you know, we share the same birthday. So, and it was awesome having him at short because I picked more guys off of second than I did at first because Barry and I had a pretty good move there. So, Joe Oliver, I know I'm not going to just name three, but, you know, Eric and I came all the way up together. I just did a banquet up there in Brookville for Dave Miley. I never got to play in the big league with Dave Miley, but he was a good teammate in AAA. But, you know, Buddy Bell probably made the biggest impression. Dave Parker for sure. But, you know, those guys, you just kind of stayed out of the way. But Buddy just seemed like the right guy. And Ronnie Oster, those two guys, we used to hang out together and drink milkshakes together. So.
Well, some great guys that you named. We're taking your calls at 513-749-7000. And we have Steve from Dayton standing by. Steve, what you got?
How you doing? Nice to talk to you, Tom.
All right, Steve, welcome.
You know, I was thinking exactly what you said in the first part. Kids that are, you know, 8 to 15-year-old, they're playing, they're having fun. Pitchers I'm talking. They get 16, 17, they're driving a car, and they're ones that are already throwing 75 to 80, 85 maybe in high school, and they're better. Maybe you could write a little book or something about how to come up with that plan so they don't overthink it, don't try to be too much, and simplify it for them.
Okay, well, that's a good thought. You know, I don't even give many lessons anymore, although I'm going to start giving some this year for the first time in a while. But, you know, with them young kids, the more you try to get them to do things, I think the more mechanical they get, and then they start trying to analyze their own delivery instead of just playing catch off the rubber and hopefully throwing it over the plate kind of thing.
Yeah, I just thought maybe a plan that they could work with the catcher so they know those. They're kind of their plan without having to just throw what's thrown down there, and they kind of have an idea.
Well, like I said, I think this generation now, because none of them are calling their own games, you know. I remember doing my own thing in Babe Ruth and American Legion and college. You know, I would change speeds on my own kind of thing, and I just you know, I just don't see those kids doing that because I think the word velocity is so prevalent now in the game of baseball.
Yeah.
That command and the ability to repeat that delivery is almost second fiddle. So,
well, I appreciate your thoughts, and Merry Christmas, and maybe you should warn the police down by that house because there'll probably be a bunch of people looking for that ball in the woods tomorrow.
Oh, well, they're not going to find it. I'm sure some squirrels tore it all up, and they use it for nesting. So, but thanks for calling,
fella.
Steve.
Steve, thank you very much. He might be onto something here. This could be a moneymaker.
No.
The Browning blueprint of how to pitch and man's. If you need a co-author, I'm available.
Well, get ready to give up a lot of home runs. If you're going to throw them the way I do, you're going to give up a lot of home runs. So.
Yeah, but most of them you gave up were solo shots.
Yeah,
that's the key, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I like to give hitters confidence, and then knowing when I had to get them out, I knew what I had to do to get them out. So.
All right. We will check in with some news around Major League Baseball coming up, including another accolade for Joey Votto. A lot of rumors going around. We'll pick Tom Browning's brain about that. Once again, taking your calls, 513-749-7000. It is the Reds Hot Stove League. We are live from the Holy Grail Banks, presented by Budweiser. It is the immortal Reds Hot Stove League, live from the Holy Grail Banks, presented by Budweiser. I'm Jim Day, and we've got Mr. Perfect Tom Browning in the house tonight. A terrific crowd on hand here at the Grail. Hopefully everyone's enjoying the holiday season. And we mentioned we're taking some calls at 513-749-7000, and we've got a couple standing by. Let's go right to them. They want to pick the brain of Mr. Perfect or anything Cincinnati Reds related. We've got Jeff in Mount Adams. Jeff, how we doing?
Yes, Tom, I have a question. When I grew up in the 50s and 60s watching pitchers like Jim Maloney and Whitey Ford and Robin Roberts, when they would warm up, they would start at 40 feet, go to 50 feet, and then 60 feet and pitch 9 innings. Today's pitchers throw long toss for 10 minutes. To me, they've already pitched 3 innings throwing long toss. What are your thoughts on that?
I wasn't a long toss guy. I was a 40 feet, 50 feet, 60 feet guy, and then I went out there and went six, so, or seven.
Or eight, yeah, or nine.
Or not, yeah. And I understand where you're coming from, and I think basically because these kids have been brought up on this long toss, we got this thing called flat ground. They're used to doing it. That's part of their routine. But I do think that long toss program, they're wasting bullets. I think that they could get ready. I mean, if they want to throw a long toss a little bit, but I wouldn't spend 10 minutes, you know. I mean, I just think that the velocity part, I always used to build up, or we were always taught to build up to gain speed, and they'll throw a few pitches, gain speed, and then go out there and pitch. You know, these guys are at game speed by the third pitch in the bullpen, and, they're just wearing themselves down more than anything else. I just think this generation now, the way that they've gone about taking all the pressure off the kids by letting the coaches call the pitches and stuff like that, and then all of a sudden they get to pro ball, and then they're kind of lost. Mm-hmm. And our job, I think, as coaches is to try and get them to figure out exactly what they're all about and how to go about attacking hitters. But, yeah, I think the long toss program, we've probably taken it a little bit further than we'd probably like to see it. The flat ground, I think. Again, these are little things that the kids have grown up with. And whether I'm a big believer or not, these kids like it, and it's part of their routine. So you kind of got to grant them their wishes in that regard. But I try to keep those guys to spend most of their time on the hill. If you want to work on pitching, let's pitch off the hill as opposed to playing the flat ground and stuff like that. But
Thanks a lot, Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling.
Jeff, thanks for your call. I want to ask you this, and this is one of these things that drives me crazy. Someone watches the game on a daily basis. It doesn't seem like the thinking man pitcher is out there anymore, particularly looking at the way that a hitter is attacking the pitcher. Maybe he throws the first pitch and the guy's leaning out over the plate, or he swings and misses at a particular ball, or a long foul ball. The guys aren't reading swings.
Correct. Yeah, they're not.
And pitching to combat that. Do you also see this, and why do you think this art form is going away?
Well, I had a kid that was threw pretty hard, and the hitter was fouling everything. Right-hand hitter, he's a right-hand pitcher, and he was a right-hand hitter, and he kept fouling everything off. He fouled like three fastballs off over the opposite field dugout. And then he threw a slider, and then the guy hit one off the wall. And he couldn't figure out why, and he said, well, you sped his bat up. All right, and he still wasn't getting to your fastball, and all you did was slow the ball down for him. So instead of him being late on your fastball, he was right on your slider. I said, those are things you got to remember. I said, because if you throw him a slider early, and now he got that in the back of his head, suddenly that fastball picks up some momentum. But these guys have never been, I don't think they've experienced that in that regard, you know. And again, I think if you put them in a setting where they can figure some of that stuff out on their own, that becomes one less or two less trips to the mound you got to make every day because they've kind of figured some of that stuff out. But I just think that they don't trust their stuff enough or that they're willing to throw it over the plate and see what happens.
And I also think the art of pitching inside with effectiveness has kind of gone away as
it
well.
It has.
And I'd love to see that come back. All right, we've got Jacob clear out in San Antonio. Jacob, how are we doing in Texas tonight? Hello, Jacob.
Hello?
Hey, Jacob, if you could turn the your phone or radio down. You're on the air, brother.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Gotcha.
Hello. My name is Jacob, and I'm 15, and from Antonia, Ohio.
And, all right, awesome.
I wasn't really expecting to be answered, I'm not going to be honest, but I have a question for Tom.
All right.
So what was your motivation as a kid to continue to play baseball and strive for your goal?
Well, it was the Cincinnati Reds, big red machine of the 70s. I thought baseball was, you know, I actually wanted to be a center fielder for the Reds. I wanted to be Cesar Geronimo, but I had to pitch.
Wow. But, never knew that.
Yeah. Well, nobody wants just to be a pitcher. So and that's all I had available to me. So I had
to don't know why. You guys have the best gig going every 5 days.
Oh, yeah, but still, you get greedy. I wanted to play the outfield one time in the big leagues just for an inning, but it never happened. But, Jacob, to answer your question, I just wanted to be able to play this game at the highest level where the best players in the world played. And I'm talking back in the mid to late 70s, my junior high and high school years. I was 155 pounds when I graduated from high school. And I got to about 185 when I was a junior in college. Of course, beer was 18 was a drinking age, so that probably helped. But I never lost sight of that goal of mine, is where I wanted to be able to play where the best players in the world played. You know, and by the time I got to be in high school, I knew it was just going to be pitching. But I never lost sight of that goal, and I was going to do everything I could.
Jacob, we appreciate the call tonight. Stay safe out there and have a good holiday season out there in San Antonio. We are blessed to have Tom Browning in the house tonight. Step aside for a break. Much more to come. It's the Reds Hot Stove League. We're live from the Holy Grail Banks. We're presented by Budweiser. All right, welcome back to the Holy Grail Banks. It's the Reds Hot Stove League, presented by Budweiser alongside Tom Browning. I am Jim Day. Congratulations, Joey Votto. He was named as the winner of the Lou Marsh Award for being Canada's most outstanding athlete of the year. That's not just in baseball, folks. That's beating out everyone in hockey as well.
Wow.
It's the second time he's won the award, and he said it kind of makes up for not winning the National League MVP. He also won it back in 2010 when he won the Most Valuable Player Award. So, I mean, we're talking about beating out Sidney Crosby, the hockey player. So in Canada, that is something. Congratulations to Joey today. Bob Costas was named the Ford Frick winner. He will be entering the broadcaster's wing of the Hall of Fame. Legendary voice as well of baseball and lover of baseball, and well-deserved there. The winter meetings continue to go on in Orlando. Kind of quiet on the Reds front a little bit. There hasn't been a move made. Today the Cardinals did acquire outfielder Jose Ozuna from the Marlins. The Marlins are doing another fire sale. That's pending a physical, so it hasn't become official yet, but that is a big move. Ozuna last year was in the top five in home runs, RBIs, hits. He is a terrific outfielder. He's going to be expensive in the future, but they're wanting to stay competitive, so the Cardinals making that move. Lots of rumors and talk of trading Billy Hamilton. There was talk about the Reds and the Giants getting together, and according to Ken Rosenthal, he says those talks have faded significantly, so we'll see what happens. It's a guy that I know you would love to have in center field if you were a pitcher. Defensively, there's none better in the league. Offensively, still working on his game. What do you think of the rumors out there?
Well, they when you get players that get to the major leagues and they're all ready to play, or at least have a chance to play, sometimes you got to trade them just to give them the opportunity, or maybe you got to use them to get us to get the Reds a better player, whatever. I love Billy Hamilton. I think defensively he's a Gold Glove guy, although he didn't win it. I think he's probably the pitcher's best friend. I hope it doesn't happen. But again, we've got Winker showed up. Obviously Duvall and Schebler, and we've got some. Players out there, but I don't think any of them are in Billy's caliber defensively, but offensively is what I think they're worried about with Billy. So
yeah, well, we'll see. It's like any deal, it just depends on what are you going to get for him. So that's always the key, obviously. So we'll see what happens on down the road. All right, we've got some callers waiting. Keith on a cell. Keith, how are we doing tonight, my man?
Hey, fine, thanks, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, Tom, on the lost baseball, what kind of punishment did you dish out?
Heck, I didn't do anything. It was a baseball.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe, hey, man, would you go out there and get my ball back up here?
I would have made him go get it.
No, it just, again, because it was, they followed the rules. It was a ball that didn't have any writing on it.
And, okay. All right.
You messed up.
I did. I screwed up. That was my fault, so. My wife still got the fur coat, though, so.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's more important. I mean, we all know that.
That's a win-win, then. Okay.
Yes.
Hey, when you pitched, I mean, a lot of the venues that you pitched in your career are no longer there anymore. Most of these ball clubs have newer ballparks, things of that nature. As a pitcher, does that make a difference on how you prep? You know,
no.
A lot of those cookie cutters that you pitched in aren't there anymore, and now the ballparks are, more open air. They've got breaks in the stands, so, there's open areas for wind and stuff. Does that make a difference, or would that make a difference?
No. You know, the only one you ever worried about that with was in Wrigley, you know, and you always kind of I like pitching with the wind blowing out because the hitters were a little bit more aggressive. When the wind's blowing in, you know, the jam shots that you get, I find a way of falling in. You know, it's just a little bit different. It's a different animal there. But for the most part, I don't think anybody does anything differently. I don't think they try to be any different no matter where they're at. I just think they try to find a way to mix whatever pitches they got into wherever ballpark they're in. But, again, I think when you have an identity, and I was a fastball changeup guy, and I never wavered from that ever. And it was my success, and I, whether it was in Wrigley Field or in San Diego or wherever. But, I just think we should spend more time throwing strikes and not so worried about so much how hard we're throwing.
Keith, we appreciate the call.
Hey, thanks for your time. Keep up the good work. Great show.
Let's go quickly to Mike in Union. We got about a minute here. Mike, what do you got?
Quick question. First of all, I enjoy listening to the show every Wednesday. My question is for you, Jim. Since the Reds didn't bring back Jim Kelce this year, and he was the other play-by-play guy besides Marty, I know you did a couple of games on the radio last year. Have the Reds talked to you about possibly doing some play-by-play on the radio this year?
Tom Browning is acting like he's interviewing me right now on the live mic. I don't know what's going to happen. I do know I'm going to be doing a few more TV games. I think the new contract that's going to kick in with Fox Sports Ohio, you're going to see some more TV games being broadcast, so I think I'll be in the mix there. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I know I'm available. I'd love to do it if the opportunity is there, and we'll just have to see.
I've heard you did a couple of games on radio last year,
if I
remember correctly, and I thought you did a pretty good job. Have you done that previously?
Not on radio since probably college, so I was kind of thrown into the fire, but I enjoyed it, and if I get more opportunities, I think I can only get better, so we'll see.
Okay, well, I was sorry to hear that Jim Kelce isn't coming back. I thought he did a good job, but I know that Marty's the only primary play-by-play guy they have now, so I know they're looking for somebody else.
Well, we'll see. If you you could be my agent there, Mike.
There you go.
Appreciate it. I'll give you a call.
All right.
All right, we got some other callers standing by. We also have a request to tell the Wrigley Field story of when you went to the rooftops and what was behind it. Oh, we've got applause for that one. So that's around the corner. Stay with us. It's the Reds Hot Stove League. We're at the Holy Grail Banks, presented by Budweiser. Reds Hot Stove League. Back live from the Holy Grail Banks, presented by Budweiser. I'm Jim Day. He is Mr. Perfect Tom Browning, and leave it to investigative reporter Dave Yiddy Armbruster. We talked about the perfect game baseball being hit into the woods at one of your previous houses. Yid hands me a sheet of paper that says Kyle in Colorado is the guy that hit that ball into the woods, and he's on the line. Kyle, what the heck were you thinking?
I had no idea it was a perfect game ball. Guess you can say being young and dumb.
Yeah, I would say that was you.
Yeah.
How you doing, Kyle?
Average, but you can't be the best. Good, sir. How are you?
Very good. How's Colorado?
Oh, beautiful.
He escaped to Colorado because he was afraid of the repercussions.
Are you down near Durango?
No, I'm a little bit away. I'm in Castle Rock area.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Yeah. Well, you lost my ball.
That's what my father just called and told me. He said I should call in and tell you how terrible I feel that I didn't even know that was a perfect game ball.
Well, the key is that Tanner didn't know anything about it, and he took it out there, so I'm not going to blame you.
It's a heck of a story to tell, though, Kyle, that you hit an historic baseball. I mean, we're talking about a perfect game. It is rare in Major League Baseball, and you hit that ball, so... You have that story to tell.
Go ahead and just rub it in there. That already hurt. But, good to talk to you and apologize about that one.
No, don't apologize, please.
An official apology, a public apology. We've come full circle here tonight on the Reds Hot Stove League. Kyle,
I have to take responsibility because I left it there for someone to grab. So I'm not holding it against you, Kyle.
I definitely Babe-roofed it, so he's gone.
Kyle, we appreciate the call, man.
Thank you, guys. Have a good night.
Thanks, Kyle.
Good luck out there in Colorado. All right, we got with the time left, we've got to get to the story, and everyone wants to get to it. Our boat captain, Hank, presented this question here tonight at the Holy Grail. The story behind the Wrigley Field, you going up on the rooftops. This was 1993, July 7th, 1993. Where did you get the idea? How this happened?
Well, actually, it was by accident because I was trying to get in the scoreboard. A buddy of mine from the Pirates got in the scoreboard, so he told me the guy to talk to when we got to Chicago, and he would take me up in the scoreboard. Well, when I got to that point, the guy wouldn't let me in there because he got in, I guess he got in some trouble for letting Bobby walk in there. So I went down and asked him. He said, "Do you want to get in the scoreboard?" I said, "I do." And he said, "I can't," blah, blah, blah. So I said, "Okay." So during batting practice, Tim Belcher and I are, you know, we're standing out in the outfield looking around. And I said, "What about one of them buildings?" So we go inside after batting practice, and Tom Hellman, the clubhouse manager, knows the guy that owns all them buildings. So his name is George Lucas. I called him on the phone. I met him across. He owned Murphy's Pub, by the way, and every building beyond there. So I met him, went three flights of stairs, got up there, waved to my guys, and I'd like to be, I mean, I can make it longer, but I'm not. So that's what happened.
We're getting the rap sign, but that will live in folklore forever. Hey, big round of applause for Mr. Perfect Tom Browning for joining us tonight. Thanks for joining us on the Reds Hot Stove League. We'll see you on down the road.